to it, and successful night, Rabbi Ben. I thank you for bringing me here. I wish you good luck tonight.
So you came to see how he's doing?
He's doing wonderful, thank God. When he leaves, I'll tell you the real story. Thank God, thank God. So I actually don't like to hear the eulogy about myself, but if you have any questions on what's happening now in Israel, what's happening around the world, I'll be happy to start out with answering your questions before we get into the presentation. Anything on your minds? We're a small group. Go right ahead. Okay. Well, as part of my job in the Strauss Amiel Institute of Or Torah Stone, I have quite a bit of travel around the world. And most of the communities are not privileged to have as many shuls as this community has. But to be more precise, most Jewish communities don't have as many Jews as you're privileged to have. And even when you have so many Jews, as you do in here in Seattle, I'm not so sure that all the Jews in Seattle find themselves coming to be part and parcel of the Jewish community. And that's what I wanted to deal with tonight, the postmodern Orthodox Jewish communities. What can we do to change that trend? And I'm talking about not so much the Jews that are part of the synagogue and the Jews that actually will continue to pay membership and come, but actually the Jews that are now up and coming. And the up and coming Jews now that are about to form families or just got married, have maybe one or two children, are struggling to buy a home and start a career. My question to you is a very simple one. Do you see them joining a shul in the next few years? Why not?
I don't think they're interested, to be honest.
So, your name? I'm sorry?
Nicole.
Nicole says they're not interested. In other words, I think what Nicole is saying is something that we have to take into consideration when we talk about what needs to change and what's not, and that is that these Jews on the periphery are not interested in joining a shul. Now, was that true 50 years ago? 50 years ago, was that true? Were there Jews out there that said, I'm a non-affiliated Jew, I'm not part of the synagogue, and I can care less? The answer is there were. But they were in the minority. Today, they're no longer in the minority.
So, you're not talking about Orthodox Jews.
I'm talking about, first of all, the Jews out there, 30, 40 years old, that are not yet part of the Jewish community. And my question is, why not? In other words, why aren't they joining a shul? Why aren't they joining a synagogue like they did 50 years ago?
Not a priority.
Why not?
They can come and go to any shul they want anytime they want without joining.
Correct.
So joining is, the question is, what does joining mean? Does joining mean coming there regularly if it's a tefillah, or does it mean paying a lot of money to do?
I think you said it better than me. Your name again?
Rivka.
Rivka said that paying a lot of money for dues. So 50 years ago, that wasn't a question. You could be a non-affiliated Jew, you would pay $50 in dues. Today, even Orthodox Jews, I'm talking about Jews that are Shomer Shabbos, will perhaps jump from shul to shul, but won't find themselves obligated in paying membership to a shul. And the question is, what changed? And in my humble opinion, what changed is an old saying in Yiddish that basically says what happens out there is about to happen to us. What's happening outside the Jewish world today? Outside the Jewish world today, quite frankly, you don't need anything but this. I'm not talking about the shtender. I'm talking about the computer upon the shtender. If you have this, or if you have this phone, then that's all you need to survive in general, and even as a Jew in particular. Once upon a time, you needed institutions for all the above. Let's just take three basic things that we do. First of all, I'm assuming everyone in this room has a bank account, correct? Okay, I'm not about to solicit you. But 50 years ago, 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, when you needed something done in your bank, what did you do? You called the bank, or you went to the bank. There's no such thing as anything else. A phone call perhaps came later, but you needed to talk to an actual person, and you needed an actual institution called the bank to take care of your banking needs. What's happening today? How many people here actually go to their bank and talk to a human being? One, two, three, four, five. Once in a while. Explain your name again, I'm sorry.
Lewis.
Lewis, what do you mean once in a while?
Once once in a while.
So ultimately,
because the computer can't do it at all. Right.
Exactly. In other words, we only go to this bank when the computer can't do it for us. But on a
one of my kids has an account where it's free checking account. But if you go to the teller, they charge you a $10 fee.
Yes.
No, it's a free account, but you can't.
A free account that if you actually talk to someone, it costs you $10.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the first and foremost thing is the most basic need of a bank is something that today we don't even need an actual bank for. As a matter of fact, I will tell you that I have a bank that doesn't exist in reality. It exists on the computer. There are people that answer the phones, but they don't have an actual bank. I can't go visit my bank. There's people I can talk to. When I deposit checks, I send it to a post box. Everything's working fine. You can have your credit card, you have everything, but with internet banking today, and with an app that comes with it, you don't need any institution at all. You never need to talk to a banker, unless you need to do something big, like get a mortgage, or perhaps go into some sort of a financial portfolio that you want to open. You don't need that institution anymore. The second institution that once upon a time that was very vital, especially for Jews that like to travel, is a travel agency. You used to go to a travel agency, and there was a travel agent, and they were the expert on travel. Today, you go to a travel agent, already you're strange. But if you happen to go there, and she or he quotes you a price, what are you going to inevitably be due a second later? You will go to Expedia, you will go to Orbitz, you will go to Kayak, you will go to Priceline, and you'll see if she's trying to gyp you, or she actually got you a better price. And travel agents know this. In other words, they understand very well that their institution is not needed today. You can book tickets online, usually for cheaper than going through a travel agent who takes a fee for her or his services. So travel agencies that once upon a time were essential to us are no longer essential because we don't need them. We have this. And number three, a synagogue. Once upon a moon, if you wanted Jewish services, you went to a synagogue to get them. But you didn't just go there once. You became a member of a synagogue because just like you were a member of other institutes and clubs and whatnot, it was considered a big deal that you're a member of a synagogue. And allow me to paraphrase this with a story. My father, he should live and be well, was once in the car with two of his colleagues from work, and they were driving, and he was driving the car, and I was in the back seat. And as they were driving, one of his colleagues pointed out, I'm a member of that church, this beautiful building. I always wondered why synagogues look so, the way they look, compared to this. And then the second gentleman, as we went past a Reformed temple, said, I'm a member of this Reformed temple. My father was embarrassed to say, oh, I go to that shtibel. But you understand that in those days, I'm not talking about ancient history here, this is about 25 years ago, maybe 27 years ago, it was considered a point of respect that you're part and a member of this club, that club, not just the synagogue. Everybody here watched the Flintstones. Where did Barney and Fred Flintstone go every night? Besides bowling.
Yeah, bowling.
Besides bowling. They went to there. Anyone remember?
The lodge.
I've seen Jewish cemeteries around the world where the symbol of the lodge was put on the matzeva, was put on the tombstone of people because they considered it part of who they are. They were in this lodge, in that lodge, the Rotary Club, this club. I have not, for the last 10 years, heard people say, I'm a member of this club, I'm a member of that club. I do hear people say I'm a frequent flyer on. But I have not heard people say, oh, I'm a member of this club, and we get together as men or as women or whatnot. And this, of course, spills over to the synagogues that we all know. Because if you don't need an institution, not for your banking and not for your travel, and not for respect, self-respect, then quite frankly, let's think about the basic Jewish needs and why do you need a synagogue? A, you have a question, a shiloh. So once upon a time, you went to your rabbi, and you asked him, Shiloh, what can you do today?
Rabbi Internet.
The problem with Rabbi Internet sometimes is there are people on the Internet, excuse me for saying so, who are ignoramuses, and you don't know who you're getting. So there could be a guy who you have no idea if he has ordination, let alone does he know anything, but you ask him the question. But usually, if you have a question, you can research it yourself. You don't need to ask your rabbi. So therefore, if you have a question in halacha, you have a question in Jewish law, you can go ahead and ask the internet. You'll find the rabbi that you trust. He does it anyway. There's plenty of them out there. As a matter of fact, there's two rabbis in Israel that already put out 3 volumes this thick of the questions they were asked on the internet. And to publish was very simple. They went to a publishing company. It was a wonderful thing. Short, concise answers on halachic topics. A lot of people bought it. It was sold out because it's easy to read. And I'm sure they'll put out another 4 volumes in the next few years.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing wrong with that. That's right. So you have the internet for the rabbi. Number two, you don't have a shaila, you have a Jewish need of some sort. A marriage, a burial. For some reason or another, you want a rabbi there. You don't need a rabbi to get married. I know that I personally officiate at weddings to make sure it's halachically correct. But quite frankly, anyone proficient on Jewish law can do it. But if you want a rabbi at your wedding, or at the circumcision of your son, not to do the bris, but to be there. Or you want a rabbi at the bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah of your son or daughter. What do you do? Quite frankly, you have to be a member of a shul. You can go ahead and make a private event and call up a rabbi who's out there, and he'll come in. And as a matter of fact, if you think about it, it's much cheaper. Because even if this rabbi has to be flown in from who knows where to Seattle, and he's taking a fee for his services, you will pay less money for that one bar mitzvah when he's 13 or that bat mitzvah when she's 12 than if you started to pay membership when they were born until their bar mitzvah. Just do the math in your head and you'll understand you're saving thousands of dollars by going and getting a rabbi who will come for whatever need you have, a bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, wedding, or whatnot. So you don't need a rabbi for shaylos today. You have the internet. You can buy a rabbi for any of the Jewish life cycle events that you have, and it's not a big deal. There's rabbis out there that are unemployed and are looking for it, and they even advertise themselves. What else did you need a shul for once upon a time?
Saying Kaddish.
Saying Kaddish.
A minyan, you know that, a minyan that you know is going to be there tomorrow.
Saying Kaddish. So, taking what I said to its logical conclusion, you would say, our host is going to say, I forgot your name, I'm sorry.
Moshe.
Moshe, our host, is going to say, well, you know, all is right, but when you need the minyan, when you need the minyan, that's where the buck stops. Let's assume, Moshe, a Jew had a yahrzeit, and you need to say Kaddish. Well, you want a minyan, for whatever reason. I am positive, that you will have 10 Jewish friends that will come together. You'll say Kaddish. They'll come for you. You'll come for them. You don't need a whole shul with maintenance, with a janitor, with a board, with the president that you don't like, and the vice president that you despise, and the treasurer that bothers you. For your minion, whatever it is. Now, if you want a minion every day, as a Jew should daven in a minion every day, the Shulchan Aruch does paskin, and I quote, Yishtadel ma'od li'palel b'beit ha'kneset im ha'tzibur. You should try very hard to pray and daven in a shul with a minion. Then, yes, you need to form some sort of a minion. But I want to be very, very clear. A minyan is only part of what we used to call a shul. A shul had many activities above and beyond the prayer services. They used to have in shuls sisterhoods and brotherhoods. There was youth programming. There was many other events that were above and beyond the actual services. But if you personally are not a religious Jew and you're not so worried about the Shulchan Aruch I just quoted, but Kaddish, you have to say, you can get a minyan together. That's not a big deal. But I'll tell you more than that. Even if you are a pious Jew that wants a minyan every day, you can probably do that as well. It's not the biggest deal in the world to get a place where you'll daven every day if people are interested. My proof. In New York and big other cities around the world, there's mincha pamphlets you can buy. You ever see them? Mincha pamphlets. Where there's minchas in office buildings.
Yeah.
Now, I know people that during the week daven every single day in New York City in a certain shul because they want to beat the traffic. So they come in very early to beat the traffic from suburbia, and then they daven in the shul, and they don't pay a cent, obviously, for davening in the shul. The rabbi of the shul is absolutely happy because he doesn't have a minyan with his own congregants during the week. But now, thanks to these commuters, he does have a minyan. So just let's think about how crazy this is. There's a shul being paid for by members that are not coming, and there's a minyan there by non-members every day. So per se, minyan, I'm sure we can organize, even if we don't have an actual synagogue. But what would happen to the synagogue we used to have with the institution of all the programming and the sisterhood and the brotherhood and the social hall and everything else that went with the synagogue? When I was growing up, and I wasn't so long ago despite the hair that I used to have, when I was growing up, the synagogue was like the second home to your home. It wasn't just the place you went to daven. It was the youth programming that you had there. It was the events that you had on Chol HaMoed when you were off from school. It was the place that you went to and frequented above and beyond minyan. And my question is today, why not? What changed? I think the answer is very simple based on what I said. We no longer have institutions that we're part of. So why would we want to be part of a shul? Why would we want to be part of a shul that takes our money every year for dues to pay a rabbi and a janitor and paying for lighting and heat and whatnot? We can get all our Jewish needs without being a member of a shul. And this is true, by the way, whether you're Orthodox or not. True. Orthodox Jews, like myself, will move to a community, look for the shul closest to the home that I'm going to buy so I can walk there on Shabbos, because I take to heart what the Shulchan Aruch paskens. Yishtadel ma'od li'palel b'beit ha'knesset im ha'tzibur. But albeit, if you think about it, if all you want is a minyan, you can organize a minyan. So why do we still need a shul today? Please explain.
For the feeling of community. Like, these are all my friends. These are all people that we all go to the same shul. 99% of us go to the same shul. And this is my community.
So, in order to answer this question, I forgot your name.
Sherry.
Sherry, our host. Right?
Yes.
Thank you. So, Sherry, who's hosting us today, together with Moshe, I think just said something that we have to take into consideration. Yishei Arim, who was the Gerer Rebbe once upon a time, has a beautiful line that I heard from my own Rebbe, Rav Amital Zichrono Levracha, many times. The Pasuk says in Parshat Ha'azinu, the famous song towards the end of the Torah, you know that Parsha right before, in between or right before Sukkot? It's like the Parsha no one talks about because you got Yom Kippur and Sukkot on either side, so like pretty much it's what I call a mate mitzvah. It's one of those dead people in the middle of the street and everyone's walking over, because no one talks about it, let's face it. This year Ha'azinu had mazel, it came out between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. I can promise you that in most shuls around the world that still exists, the rabbi got up and talked about Sukkot. Usually Ha'azinu is Parshat Shabbos Shuvah. I promise you the rabbi doesn't get up and quote a pasuk from Ha'azinu. So Ha'azinu, I always felt, was a parsha you have to quote during the year. So even though we just finished Leining Va'era this morning, we're going into Bo this week, allow me to quote a pasuk from Ha'azinu just to give it a little cover. You know, you have to give cover to the people that don't get the respect. It says in the pasuk, Zechor Yemot Olam, remember what was, Binu Shnot Dov Rador, study the generations or the years of each decade. What does it mean, study the generations of each decade? How do you study the decade? How do you study the generation? Explain the Chidushei Harim, and I'd like to quote his words as opposed to my words, something beautiful that I'd like to share with you. He says, and I quote, B'chol Dor V'Dor in every generation, V'chol Tkufa in every new era, Ba'a havana chadasha b'Torah min hashamayim. There's a new understanding of the same Torah. In other words, the same Torah, the same pasuk, the same Gemara is now understood differently. Shehi matima lador. That's appropriate and suitable for that generation. V'tzadikei kol dor mevinim b'Torah kifim ha'shedarush lamedet b'nei hador b'doro. And the tzaddikim, because he was a Hasidic Rebbe, he had to say tzaddikim, but we can take out that word and say the rabbis, or we could take out that word and say the Jewish leaders, or we could take out that word and say parents, whatever you would like, of every generation, comprehend the Torah as it's needed to teach that ones living in that generation. So what does that pasuk mean according to the Chidushei Harim? It basically means that every generation has different Torah needs, different Jewish needs. And the fact that once upon a time this is the way we did it does not mean that's the way we're going to do it in the future. The Torah does not change. But the application of the Torah to every generation will change. And I'll just give you one simple example. Any of you have been to Europe to see old synagogues in Eastern Europe? Mm-hmm. How many of them had women's sections? Galleries, women's sections.
All of them?
Allow me to share some news with you.
Okay.
Many of them didn't. You look, you can't find it. In Prague, for example, you go to what's called the Oidshul, the old shul, where the Maharal from Prague, Davin. Say thank you for the correction. Altneushul. In that particular shul, you see no women's section. You see the dungeon where they locked up the Jews that didn't pay their taxes or their shul dues. And I didn't see the golem because he probably didn't exist. But
there was a wall between and a room in the back.
There's a room in the back. But the whole idea of a mechitza, of a synagogue, with due respect, it didn't happen. Why? I'm not saying every shul. There were shuls that had. Yes, not the Ramos shul in Krakow. I was there recently. I didn't see any women's section. There's another shul there that had.
Women didn't go to shul.
Women didn't go to shul. Some of them couldn't read. Some of them did not go to school. I'm not talking about Jewish school. I'm talking about school in general. They didn't read. They ultimately did not go to shul. Maybe they taught them to read, but going to shul was a novelty. Not many necessarily did it. Now,
I have to disagree with your rabbi.
Go right ahead.
We have in our home books called Senerenas,
yeah.
Where the way women learn the old the Jewish kind in Yiddish. So they had to learn how to read.
In Yiddish, yes, you know, absolutely.
I'm son of people who came from Europe. And
absolutely.
All of the women of that generation knew how to read.
I am sure they knew how to read.
I don't know from what I've
read.
First of all,
the Senerena is not from the last generation.
No, it's not from the last generation. It's probably a few generations already. However, not all women knew how to read at all times. Because they were not taught. They didn't necessarily go to school. At a certain point in history, they learned how to read Hebrew and the vernacular wherever they were. And all of a sudden, if they know how to read, then the next step happened. Sarah Schneer came along in the 20th century and said, they know how to read, they absolutely go to regular school, so we have to give them a Jewish education now. We can't just assume that their mother or their father will teach them the basics of Judaism. Now, what happened? The Torah changed? Torah didn't change. The Torah had the same initiative from day one. We want Jewish men and women to be wonderful, steadfast Jews. But once upon a time, this was achieved by men going to cheder and eventually yeshiva, perhaps. And I'm saying perhaps because yeshiva is a new invention. And seeing what's happening at home. Women seeing what's happening at home, basically only. And they build good Jewish homes that way. We still want to build good Jewish homes today. But when women today go to university, and every opportunity is open to them. So the Chafetz Chaim, who was no Reformed Jew, together with the Gera Rebbe at the time, and the Belzer Rebbe at the time, all encouraged Sarah Schneer to open up the first Beis Yaakov in order to achieve the same goal, to have good, steadfast Jewish homes, albeit with different means. Now you can understand why today it is unthinkable to build a synagogue of any sort and not have a women's section. In any community, for that matter, from the Hasidic communities to the left-wing Orthodox communities that we have today, there is absolutely unthinkable, any of them, regardless of what they think of women and feminism and all these words out there today, they will have a women's section, because women today, thank God, could read. Many of them are Torah scholars. Some of them can even give a shir on a much higher level than myself. I would even say most of them. And they are wonderful, and they want to come to synagogue and daven and get close to Hashem, just like men. Just like it was. But once upon a time it was achieved one way. Today it's achieved a different way. So, says the Chidushei Harim, Torah doesn't change. But in order for you to achieve the same goal, you have to apply the ancient Torah to the new generation and the trends that are happening. So if the trends happening today are institutions are out, organized religion is going down, how do we apply the synagogue to the new generation? In my humble opinion, what our host told us a few moments ago, I'm sorry, I have a long evening, a long day. Sherry. Moshe and Sherry. Sherry. Cheryl?
Sherry.
Sherry. That's fine. So Sherry, I hope you're hearing me, because I'm saying this in your honor, of course. Sherry said to us a few moments ago, first and foremost, there's two reasons basically why Jews come to synagogue today. And they want a synagogue and not just a minyan or Jewish services. Not everyone, but most. A, she said the word community. Now let's break up that word and understand, what does it mean, community? It means a sense of what?
Belonging.
Belonging. In other words, what we call in Hebrew, shayachut. I belong to a group of friends who I go to shul with, because I like to be with these group of friends once a week. We don't just go to shul to daven. We go to shul after, hopefully after davening, to talk. Hopefully after davening, to talk. And we also spend our happy occasions together, like bar mitzvahs and weddings and afrots and whatnot. And lo aleinu, when there's sad occasions like shivas and whatnot, they're also the people. That's the first reason why we, as a Jewish community, still want to have that community, because of belonging. We need that shayachut. We belong to a group of people. We're together once a week. We're not just a family with a father and a mother and a few kids, but rather we belong to something bigger than us. And that sense of belonging is something that today people are looking for, despite everything out there to the contrary. And I'll just give you one example. This example is hard for me to say, because I couldn't get through the article without crying, and I don't cry too often. But I heard about the article from Rabbi Riskin, and I went to the internet, and I read it, and I couldn't get through it without tears. How many people here are on Facebook? Okay. How many friends do people have on Facebook sometimes? Thousands? Hundreds? There was a girl that had hundreds of friends on Facebook. She had a birthday. She decided she's inviting all her friends, quote unquote, on Facebook to her birthday. Not one showed up. Not one. True story reported in the Jerusalem Post. I'm sure the Jerusalem Post doesn't always quote everything authentically, but this one would be too hard to make up. And what did they gain out of it? There's an illusion that we have friends because they're friends on Facebook. They push the word like. You think they really like what you wrote. But quite frankly, let's be honest with each other. I looked this evening at Facebook just quickly to see what I missed in the last 25 hours of Shabbos. God forbid you're disconnected. So, run through it. A lady posted, and I quote, with great sadness that my beloved grandmother, 86-year-old, passed away. 25 people like. What did you like? You like that she passed away? What did you like? It's beyond me. But the whole terminology of Facebook is the way it is. There's friends, there's like, there's no I would like to show my solidarity with you in your time of mourning button. There's only a like button or an unlike button, so that's what it is. So quite frankly, that's what Facebook is. I had another invitation this evening to come to an event of one of our graduates in Australia, because when they invite people to events, they invite all their friends. So they don't care that you're in Seattle, they're in Australia. I don't even know how many hours we're apart. About 14, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Yeah.
About 14, that's 14 all the way. 10 to Israel, no, it's more. It's already 19. 19 hours to Australia. They invite you, they invite this guy, that guy. There's no real relevance. So today, when you talk about a friend, the one that you want to have a cup of coffee with, not the one on Facebook, the community can give that. The shul can give that. And the community, therefore, has to not just be a place of davening. It has to be a place that encourages that feeling of community, of belonging. In other words, if we invest all our time and our efforts into the davening, per se, namely a three-hour service with a long speech and every mishaberach under the sun and under the bima, you all understand that's not going to happen. Not in our shul. My shul, by the way, doesn't have mishaberachs. It's an interesting. Okay, interesting. Mishaberechs, by the way, do save a lot of time. On the other hand, doesn't give the proper respect sometimes to the people that are looking for it. There's ways to deal with this. I was privileged to publish a book on davening 2 years ago, and I've been asked by various places to talk about it. One of my ideas is to eliminate the Mishaberechs on Shabbos morning and only use them at a simcha, and even then in an abridged version. And it saves a lot of time, and people have better kavana in davening for Shachris and Musaf. And the reason I got to the conclusion I did was I looked, and I was in Halifax for 4 years, and I asked the reverends and the other clergymen, because I was the only rabbi, so we needed someone to talk to. So I asked them, you know, are your pews empty? They said, yeah, our pews are also empty. But when people come, do they pray? And they say, yeah. So that's great. And they concentrate, yeah. And I said, well, how long is your service?
20 minutes.
That's an hour to an hour. So how do you expect people for 3 hours to, you know, really get into it? It's going to be very difficult. So therefore, if we're going to have a synagogue, we have to offer many other things to give that sense of belonging. It has to be a place that encourages people to belong to it. And therefore, when they come there, they feel that sense of belonging. So I'll just give two examples, and you can give many more. Number one, announcements. So once upon a time, they announced the major events of life. I call them the radical events of life, namely when you're born, when you die, and in between, when you have a bar mitzvah and a wedding. Today, I think that shuls have to include in their announcements graduations and anniversaries and prizes that people got or recognition that people got, because that gives you a sense of belonging. Imagine on shul on Shabbos, they say, we want to wish Mr. and Mrs. X a happy anniversary. They didn't have their 50th anniversary. They didn't even have their half jubilee anniversary. Just an anniversary. So people come up to you and wish you a happy anniversary. The 20 people give you that sense of camaraderie and belonging. You had a question,
well,
sir, yes.
Actually, we're talking about
Mr. Jaffe, right? Yeah.
When we're talking about community, there's so many communities that all of us participate in. How does the Jewish community make a claim that's over and above the claim of other communities?
Well, I don't think the Jewish community can make a claim that they're above and beyond other communities. But I think in the Orthodox world, we have this illusion that if we continue to run the shuls like we've done all the time, we're going to have the same amount of people. Quite frankly, that's not happening anymore. And therefore, there's many synagogues out there, big synagogues, it used to be major synagogues, that are empty. And the small little shtiebels are full. So I want to say, how do we, you know, fill up the pews again? First and foremost, we have to give that sense of belonging. Well, shtiblach do give you that sense of belonging. It's small. People know each other. There's probably a kiddush every Shabbos. These are things that will bring people to the shtibl. And because of this, they're willing to pay. There's no problem with the money per se. They're willing to pay because it gives us that sense of belonging. So if once upon a time you belonged to a synagogue because you belonged to a synagogue, period. I don't care who you were. Today that's not going to happen because institutions are out. The only way it's going to happen is if we encourage that sense of belonging. And I mentioned the announcements, namely that not just the big events, but even small events. And number two, the thank yous. It's a beautiful minhag we have in shul and Ashkenazi shuls. If there's any Sfaradim here, then I apologize, but it's the same idea. When you get an aliyah, what do they tell you afterwards?
Yashar Koach.
Yashar Koach. And Asfardi Shul Chazak Ubaruch. What does Yashar Koach mean?
You should be strong.
Go to strength. Right? Okay. Why do you say that?
That's what the generation before us.
You got it.
You just donated some money for the shuls.
Halavai. Not always do we sell aliyahs and donate money to the shuls for an aliyah. So they call you up for an aliyah. What did you do? What was the big achievement? You said the same bracha every trained 13-year-old boy can say. So you got up there, and you said Baruch Hu and Baruch Hu, and finished. You didn't read, you didn't lean. All you did was say two brachas. And everyone says, Yeshakolach, you should go to strength. You really worked hard. You need a lot of strength now. You know, you just hold two suitcases or whatnot. I lost my suitcase on the way here. It's on my mind. Don't worry, it's just my clothing. It will sometimes, it will come. Make a long story short, why do you say Yeshakolach? In my opinion, it's over-exaggerating what this person did. But just imagine the sense of belonging that he feels after you say Yeshakolach. The whole shul got up and said Yeshakolach to him. or 25 people shook his hand, only for getting an aliyah, that makes the person feel very, very good. So I'm going to say, it's not just the announcements of an anniversary, this, that, the other thing. If someone went ahead and set up the Shalosh Shudas, that person has to be announced. And if someone decided on helping you with the website of the shul, that person has to be recognized and thanked publicly. In every single way the shul announces it, from the bima and in the announcements that are printed still on the bulletin board for reasons that are beyond me, but that's the way it is. That's the Jewish custom, a bulletin board, despite the fact that we have phones and whatnot. And in the email and the Facebook and everything else. Huh? They can't read those on Shabbos. That's the bulletin board. But if you print it up before Shabbos, you have it. I always wondered why they still have a bulletin board. But quite frankly, I don't understand why in an Orthodox shul today, when people know when davening is, they can print it up before Shabbos or they can write it on a piece of paper. How come someone gets up and says, Mincha today will be at? Everybody knows that. No. That we should take out.
No.
Not everyone? Okay. No. You don't, you don't. That doesn't take a lot of time. No. You can say Mincha today, Ma'ariv today, Shachris this week will be exactly the same as last week, and nothing changed, but that's okay. But this week's Rosh Chodesh, so maybe one day will be a little change. Fine. But you know what the announcement should be about? There should be a lot in there about the people in the shul. Namely, we want to thank whoever who put up the balloons at the kids' party that we had this week. And then after shul, people are going to go up to that person and say, thank you for putting up the balloons. And we want to thank this person. We want to acknowledge this boy and that girl. All of a sudden, the shul is a camaraderie of people that makes you feel you belong to something. And that's a very strong and profound feeling. And that's one of the main reasons of two that I believe people today will join shuls. The sense of community, as Sherry said, the sense of belonging.
Another thing we started to do, in fact, Bayless in charge of it, is a greeting card. And anybody who walks in shul who's new, you don't recognize, we have people that specifically go up and greet them. I mean, everybody greets them, but
you took the words right out of my mouth, Sherry, so allow me to just continue. Sherry said it, and I'm just going to explain what I think Sherry said. Bela, you can tell me if this is what you do. You come into shuls sometimes. It's a very unfriendly place, if you think about it. You walk in, the first thing you see is books in Hebrew. As a matter of fact, if you think about davening in general and shul, davening in shul, basically, you're telling people to come to a place they'd rather not be in, to pray in a language they don't understand for things they probably don't even need. Did I sum it up? Now, think about it. They come into shul, they see these books and papers. Nothing that talks to them. Imagine if you came into the shul and there's a greeter that comes and says, welcome, what's your name? Are you visiting? Are you from town? Come on in. You can sit wherever you want or sit in that seat. Men's section and women's section included in this. That gives you a totally different feeling about that shul. As opposed to coming into a shul where no one greets you, no one says hello or good morning to you, you sit down, you can leave, no one notices you. Now, quite frankly, that's what happens on the street. Once upon a moon, I still remember, even me, that when I walked down the sidewalk in the morning, people greeted you with good morning. Today, no one greets you, not because they're rude. They're nice people. They just don't notice you. You know why? I'll tell you why. First of all, they can bump into you because they're texting on their phones as they walk. Is there a law here you're not allowed to hold your phone when you drive?
Yes.
Baruch Hashem. It's a very important law, by the way. Pikuach nefesh dochet kol ha-torah kula. That's pikuach nefesh. Mamish. Pikuach nefesh to hold your phone when you drive. Thank God in Israel there is a law like that, because you know how Israelis drive. And thank God for inventing this wonderful tool. It's wonderful. You press a little button when people call you. It's terrific. But I wish they would make a law for pedestrians as well. Because what happens on the street? First of all, people text as they walk and they bump into you. Not a tragedy usually, but uncomfortable it is. Two, the phone does many things. Amongst them is music. Or if you're really from, shiurim. My phone has shiurim on it. I can put on wireless earphones that are noise canceling. Not only don't I hear you, I don't even notice you. I can walk right past you on the street, but I'm not with you. I'm in my shiur, I'm in my music. I'm not with you. Once upon a time, without the phones, you were in the street. You said good morning, good evening. You don't do that today because you're not there. You're physically there, but you're not there. So therefore, If this is the generation we're living in, just imagine what happens. Someone comes into shul. Same thing. I've been to shuls around the world for minyan during the week. So I come into shul for a minyan, a daily minyan. I'm not talking about Shabbos. A daily minyan. I was there 3 days straight. New face. Doesn't look like one of the crowd. No one said hello, good morning, where are you from, or whatnot. In smaller communities, usually yes, because you probably make their minyan, so they really appreciate you. But in bigger communities, there's 20 people there, you're 21, and now no one notices you. Now why would you have any motivation to come back there? You'd say, it's like the street. So what? I go to the street when I need to go to the street. I don't go to the street because I want to be there. I'm not going to pay to go on the street. So I only go to the street if I need it. So if I need a kaddish, I need a this, I'll go. But if, imagine if you go into a shul, and as opposed to what happens on the sidewalk where everyone's connected to their phones, people actually greet you and say, welcome, we're happy you're here. And a week later, a few days later, the rabbi of the community says, it was wonderful to see you there. That would encourage people to be part of a shul, because it gives them that sense of belonging. So thank God, Bela, you do it, and I'm very happy. I'm sure you have many wonderful, wonderful helpers. But I have to tell you that what you said should not be taken for granted, because it's not happening anywhere else. It's not happening on the streets anymore. It's not happening on the sidewalks. If it happens in the shul, then people will say, this is a special place. This gives me a sense of belonging. But there's one more reason that I think today Jews will come into shul. And that's not the sense of shayachut, of belonging, but rather a sense of mashmahut, significance. And the reason I got to this was for the following reason. And as Rabbi Hassan said, one of my hobbies is I officiate at weddings in Israel, mainly for the non-religious population. The reason I started it, and it's no secret anymore, is that once upon a time, if you're a non-religious Jew in Israel, you don't go to shul at all. That has not changed so much till this day, except for a few places. When do you need a rabbi? I mean, really need a rabbi? When you get married. Because according to the laws of the state of Israel, it's absolutely illegal to get married in any other way for a Jew than by a rabbi who is authorized by the chief rabbinate. As a matter of fact, if you're a rabbi with ordination and you marry someone in Israel not through registering with the rabbinate, it is illegal, it is a crime. So, when I got back to Israel, I took my chances and I decided I'm going to go and try to get a license. At that time, they didn't have any loopholes. And thank God I got one. So I marry couples that basically get a rabbi for free. They always ask me how much I charge. My answer is I charge a lot. I want you to meet with me before your wedding. Sit down with me, come to my living room. We'll talk about your wedding. We'll plan it out together. Then we'll talk about a little Jewish life and what it's like, married life. And you'll be surprised how many secular Jews in Israel are interested to hear what an Orthodox rabbi has to say about married life. They live together already, so believe me, they're not looking for any of the guidance in that area. But they want to know what it's like to have kids, and how do you nurture a relationship with your children, and how do you maintain loving your wife 10, 20 years down the line, loving your children, making time for them as you're working and making a career. And what does Judaism have to say about it? You'd be surprised how interested they are. The reason I say this is that after that one meeting, and Baruch Hashem, we get to a chuppah, I do get calls afterwards when certain challenges come up in their lives. I'm not in any which way an expert on solving anything, but advice I can give as someone that's been married for almost 16 years. And I always tell them, I am just giving advice. Don't take me as professional advice. And every rabbi has to know, by the way, where his limitations are in this area. Because some rabbis do think that they are experts in everything. Thank God I know I'm an expert in nothing. So I know my limitations. So certain rabbis used to have Rolodexes. I have a phone. And when someone has problems in a certain area that I think is above and beyond what I could do, I call the professionals, either to consult with them or I send them to the professionals based on their need. Anyway, make a long story short, I do the weddings for free. And ultimately, people don't necessarily like that, because many rabbis in Israel were not doing weddings for free. They were doing weddings for money, and they didn't exactly report that money. So all of a sudden you're taking away their parnasa, quote unquote. Even though rabbis in Israel that are rabbis of towns or of communities, meaning rabbanei shchuna, rabbanei ir in Hebrew, are not allowed to take money by law. for weddings. Now, even if you're not, like I'm not, you have to report it to the IRS. This is money. So I don't take money. And that, of course, is not something that's very popular necessarily with the rabbinate. Now, I asked these couples after a while, you've been living together for 5 years. You basically have no problem to have kids today. We once thought that if you're married, if you're not married and you have kids, it's terrible. You're called, God forbid, a bastard. Everyone found out that mamzer does not mean that in halacha. So today, many people have kids without being married. It's totally and utterly okay. Just like it's all totally and utterly okay to assimilate, it's totally and utterly okay to have kids even when you're not married. So I ask these couples straight out sometimes, why do you want to get married now? Know what their answer is? Anyone want to guess? Not for kids.
They want to have a commitment to the relationship.
A commitment. That's definitely one of their answers. Commitment. They don't want him to cheat on her or her to cheat on him. Commitment. But if they're already living together for 5 years, it seems like the commitment is there. You know what the second reason they give? It gives significance to us living together. No longer are we just living together, we're now married. And that gives significance to what we're doing as a husband, not just as a man and a woman, but now as a husband and wife. And again, these are people that can have already a kid. I've married couples, the wife was as pregnant as the wife-to-be, was as pregnant as you wouldn't, impossible to hide under the wedding dress, let's put it that way. Believe me, that's not the reason necessarily today they're getting married. They're getting married because they want to give significance to their togetherness. They're ready for that step. I think people will come to shul today if you can knock significance into their Judaism, into their life, both their Jewish life and their regular life. If you can give significance to what they're doing, then all of a sudden their religion is not primitive. It's not just, I ate the matzah. I shook the lulav. I lit the Hanukkah candles. I heard the Megillah. But rather there's significance to all those acts. There's a residue that stays with you above and beyond and far after you actually did the act. So when you go to shul, you don't just say, what did you do today? I've already davened. Many Jews, as Rav Soloveitchik said, like to be in a situation that they have davened, but they don't like davening. So, if you want Jews to say, I didn't just daven, past tense, but rather, I davened. And let me tell you, the residue is still with me. The experience is still there. I'm on a high. Then we have to give them that significance in shul. Now this has many ramifications on things that happen in a synagogue. Number one, the davening has to be inspirational. Much more inspirational than if I would daven at home. Or if I went to the big synagogue with the chazan that sings the songs from 20 years ago. It has to be an inspirational service. When people ask me, what tunes are you allowed to use, not allowed to use in davening? There's a lot of literature on the tunes you're allowed to use, not allowed to use. Just parenthetically, if you want to know, in Italy, there was a great rabbi, shall remain nameless, but wrote a responsum, so he's a very great rabbi, that basically said you're allowed to use the church tunes. Not only are you allowed to, but you have to. Because the Jewish tunes, excuse me for saying, still stink. And the church tunes are very profound tunes. Nobody agreed with him. But this is written 16th, 17th century. Of course, there's that notion that they all stole the tunes from the Beis HaMikdash, and that's how they got it, and they're coming back to us. But in general, we all know we're not going to take church tunes. Fine. So what tunes do you use for Lechadodi, Keladon, and all the rest of those parts of davening? My answer has always been the same. I said, first of all, try to use Jewish tunes, of Jewish singers. Let's go down that path. But not necessarily, not necessarily. I said, the tunes that make you get on a high at a wedding, if it's a part of davening that's happy, or make you very sad on a Tisha B'Av, is the tunes you use. But the tunes that do nothing for you, leave out. So just because they sang Hodu Hashem Ki Tov this way for all these years, does not mean that we have to continue using that same tune today. I remember, not so many years ago, 5 years ago, Yom HaAtzma'ut in Israel. I know that in North America there's a big machloket, should you say Hallel or don't you say Hallel on Yom HaAtzma'ut within the Zionist communities. And if you say challah with the bracha, without a bracha. And even then, do you say it on the 5th of Iyar, or on the day that in Israel they're celebrating Yom HaTzmaut? Yom HaTzmaut has this wonderful property to it, that it barely comes out on the 5th of Iyar, in Israel. But in Israel we don't have these machlokeses. It comes down to very simple. If you're a Zionist, religious Zionist, you say halal. And if you're not a religious Zionist, you don't say halal. Regular day. Let's just keep it at that. Approximately. So, if you're a religious Zionist, you're saying halal. And that's the main event of davening that morning. You're saying thanks to God for giving us Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel. So I was in a shul in Efrat where I live. And a chazan gets up. And he gets to the part of Hallel that I think is the climax of Hallel. Hodu laHashem ki tov ki lo olam chasdo l'sgletz. Thank God for His grace and for His wonderful kindness to us. How does he sing it? I kid you not, excuse my voice. Hodu laHashem ki tov. I almost fell asleep by the end. But I didn't. I got very upset. Because that happens to be the tune, Shlomo Karlebach, that I use as a chazan on Rosh Hashanah for Unatana Tokif. Now you can decide which of us are right. But I am positive that even if you don't like the tune, it should not be used for challah. And if it's used in challah, it should not be used for the words, Hodu LaHashem Ki Tov. Imagine saying in English, thank you God. Makes no sense. So I couldn't stop myself, as I sometimes can't. And I went up to this fine gentleman and I asked him, by the way, why did you choose that tune? You know what his answer was? It popped into my head. Meaning, I don't know what I was saying, I don't know what part of Hallel I'm in, I don't know I'm saying Hallel, I don't know what I'm thanking God, but it popped into my head. If davening is not inspirational, if you don't dance, not dance necessarily, but you don't come out of davening saying, wow, that was something, then why would people go daven there? They'll do a quick minyan inside a house and finish.
True.
Davening has to be inspirational. It has to give significance to the words you say every day. And therefore we have to invest in the tunes we use and when we use them and how we use them. I'll just give you another example on the other side of it. A wonderful chazan who knows what the words mean. Once upon a time, even Chazanim didn't know what the words meant. You know the jokes about Chazanim, right? I don't have to tell you. Okay. The jokes about Chazanim are known. Motzei Shabbos, we can say a few jokes. The famous joke about the Chazan, it wasn't religious, so Yom Kippur is Yom Kippur, what are you going to do? But he's not religious, so you know, he made a living because he had a good voice. So where did he eat? He's in shul all day. The joke was, that's why you fall down Korim. Under the talus, he had a sandwich. You never heard that before? Wow, okay. Chazanim are a wonderful, wonderful... Once upon a time, there were people made fun of Chazanim. I don't know who they make fun of today in shuls, but they used to make fun of Chazanim. There's a Chazan I know who knows the words, beautiful. On Yontif, on a holiday of a certain... It was Shavuos, I believe. Shavuos is a hard holiday in Israel because it's just one day. People attempt to stay up at night. They can't necessarily get through the night. They wake up for davening in the morning groggy. And this chazan knew that, and he got up and he started to sing beautiful karblach nigunim that brought out the words, Atabechartanu mikol ha'amim, you've chosen us for all the nations, the beginning of the Amidah, of the holidays, Sahafta otanu, you loved us, Veratzita banu, you wanted us, etc., etc. And then he got to the words, Umifnei chataenu galinu me'artzenu. And because of our sins, we were exiled from the land. You know how he said those words? Using the tune from Eicha. All of a sudden, the people in shul understood, A, it's not a happy part of davening. Because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. We can't bring the korbanot that we're supposed to bring on this holiday. And B, people talked about it afterwards. That's an inspirational service. That's one that people say, wow. Number two, we have to give people significance into the mitzvot that they do. So there has to be a lot of talk in shuls by people giving speeches or shiurim about things that we do every day. It could be the brachot we say, it could be the matzah we ate. It can't just be halacha, this is what you do. It has to be significance given to what we do every day. Example of many. You can give many, many different examples. I'll just give one example. Every almost every single Jew in the world on Hoshana Rabbah will find himself in a shul, and if they don't, they take Hoshana, the five willow branches, and they smack him on the floor 5 times. They leave shul that day. You ask them, what did you do in shul? It's a long service on Hoshana Rabbah. Oh, I smacked the Rabbah on the floor. Now what is that all about? Now the problem is that on Sukkot, usually we don't talk about these things, because we don't talk about these things. We only talk about big, wonderful ideas, philosophical ideas, but let's talk about what we do every day. Namely, not big philosophical ideas. Why do we smack a Ravot on the floor? Anyone have a suggestion? It's a min of Nevi'im. It comes from the prophets. We continue to this day. Okay, there is a Kabbalistic notion that it sweetens the din. I personally am not a Kabbalist. Well, let's say I'm a lay member of the shul. I don't understand what it means to sweeten. How do you sweeten by smacking something? I don't know. Usually when you hit something, it's not exactly sweet. What is it about? Ever think about, why are we doing it?
It's like Jimi Hendrix breaking his guitar at the end of a concert.
That's a good one.
Seriously. I mean, this thing has been part of your life for a week, and you're done.
You're done?
And you're marking the end of a specific period of time, and the entry into another way.
So it's interesting. All week we don't have visa revolt. You're correct about the, if that was what we do with the Lulav and Etrog, I said that has to be the explanation. The Lulav and Etrog, Hadassah and Aravot are with us all week, except for Shabbos. And on the last day of Sukkot, you can't throw them out yet. You have to wait till the day is over, because it's Huksa l'mitzvato, it's designated for the mitzvah. So yes, you can actually throw them in the garbage a day later, but it's a beautiful minhag to save Etrogim, as we could see right over there. And also, what do you do with the Lulav?
Fire for
use it to burn the chametz. Very good, very good. So basically, that's what we usually do with the lulav. But okay, the rabbot are only with us those 5 on Hoshana Rabbah, meaning it's only with us for less than 24 hours. We buy it the night before that morning. I don't know why willow branches probably cost a penny. Will probably cost $10 at least, but we all know why. And we take them to shul and we smack them on the floor. What's that all about? Now, you can give many explanations. I'm just going to give you one that resonates with me. I think it's a normative explanation. The last mitzvah of a holiday season with a lot of mitzvahs, from blowing the shofar, to building the sukkah, to sitting in the sukkah, to going ahead and taking the arba minim, to fasting on Yom Kippur. A lot of mitzvahs. What's the last mitzvah that we do on Hoshana Rabbah? Last one. We listen. If there's one thing we don't do enough of today, is listening. We don't listen. We barely listen to each other. Let's face it. You start a conversation with your kid. The minute you start talking, they take out their phone. You start a conversation with a human being. I'm at meetings with people. How are you? Very good. I wanted to talk to you about something. The phone rings. Immediately. The phone is more important than you. Why? Because maybe someone's calling me. Okay, I know someone's calling you, but you know, there's something called an answering machine. You can see the calls that have called. You can put your phone on silent. They look at their phone. Now, sometimes, I'm not saying if your wife is in the emergency room or about to give birth, you should put your phone on silent. But let's face it, not every single person calling you is vital and important. But quite frankly, today, because of the phone, we barely listen to people. So therefore, imagine the last thing you do in shul before you go into the end of the holiday season is to listen. What do you listen to? The smacking of the rabbot on the floor. Not so hard to listen to. Everyone hears it. But that's what you do. That's the last thing God wants to say to you. Listen to other people. Listen to the world around you. Now you can agree or disagree with my explanation, but I'm saying you have to take what people do all the time and knock significance into it, because if not, it's going to be a very primitive religion of I lit my candles, I listened to the Megillah. So what? So a trained monkey can do all of that too. You can train a monkey to sit at a Seder, and he'll take the requisite amount of matzah, and he can even train him to make a bracha, and he'll lean on his left side, and he'll eat the matzah within the right amount of time with the stopwatch. Very nice. What's the difference between the monkey and the Jew? Anyone?
It should be Talmud Torah.
Talmud Torah. Let's take that a step further. The monkey remains a monkey after he eats the matzah. He may be constipated, but he remains a monkey. The Jew that might get constipated should transform and change. He just did a mitzvah from the Torah. As a matter of fact, the only mitzvah left, says the Chasam Sofer, of eating that we have today, midoraita, biblical. We used to have mitzvah to eat korbanot and whatnot, like the korban pesach. The only mitzvah left of eating midoraita today is the matzah on the Seder night. Now you eat the matzah and nothing changes except for the matzah was stale this year. The matzah was good this year. This was pretty not fair. That's it? There must be something that transformed, that changed. What is it? We have to try to uncover that. If we give significance to what people do outside of shul, then ultimately they'll come to shul to gain more and more significance. And that's what I think you meant when you say Talmud Torah. Because quite frankly, if we're not going to talk about these things, and we'll just have our normal daf yomi, and our this, and our that, then what we do every day becomes useless. And I'll just illustrate this with the story of my own son. My son entered Yeshiva High School this year, and they wanted to put him in the, not regular Gemara class, but the advanced Gemara class, which is, I'm boasting, very nice to hear. So, I said, what are they learning in the advanced Gemara class? So he said, we're ninth grade, the whole yeshiva is learning, I don't know, Sanhedrin, and we're learning Brachot, because we're only ninth grade. Brachot is supposed to be easy. So we're learning the easy Masechta, and the rest of the high school is learning the hard Masechta. So they want to put me in a class of a select five that's going to learn the hard Masechta. I said, you do what you think is right, I'm totally against it. He said, why? I said, first of all, I don't like this elitist attitude of those five boys, even though I can understand it. You have it in mathematics and English. There's English speakers versus Hebrew speakers in Israel. It doesn't sit well with me. I'm not saying it's the end of the world. But the second reason I said is much more vital. If you're learning brachot, by the end of the year, you will understand why you make a bracha on this thing like this, and on rice, the bracha is mezonot, and the bracha achrona is borei nefashot. You won't just do it, you'll understand where it comes from and why. You won't just say Shema, you'll know what Shema is, where it's learned from, why you do it twice a day, and what it means. You'll knock significance into the daily routine that you go through every single day. If you learn Sanhedrin, on the other hand, then the daily routine remains a daily routine of you get up, you wash your hands, you say this, you do that, you put on this tefillin, you put your eyes over your head over here. You don't gain significance to any of that. You can, I asked it right straight out, why do you cover your eyes when you say Shema? There's a Gemara in Brachos that talks about why. A beautiful minhag of Rebbe. And there's a machloket why he covered his eyes. Everyone covers their eyes when they say Shema. They don't know why, they think that's what Jews do. But quite frankly, there is an explanation for it. You can find the explanation. And you knock significance into what we do every day. So in my humble opinion, if we want to maintain modern Orthodox shuls the way we would like it, a shul, a proper place, with membership fees, we have to give people two things. One is what Sherry called a sense of community and I called belonging. And the second is significance. Significance to what they do every single day. And that means things that happen in the shul are significant, like the davening, and they have to be invested in, and the speeches and the shiurim. They have to be significant to the life we lead outside of shul. If not, if they're totally detached from it and have nothing to do with it, unfortunately I will see many, many more Jews detach themselves from shuls, and I personally don't want to see that. And therefore, I believe that if we combine both belonging and significance, we will find more Jews in shul. And we have to be sensitive to both. And not just say, this is the way it is here. And just to take davening again as an example, I mentioned before the tunes we use, where people come out and say, wow, that was something. You know when else they'll say, wow? And I'm sure you're sensitive to this. When somebody takes responsibility over the timing of davening. Now, when do you start davening? There's halachot. There's man kriyat shema, there's man tefillah, fine. How long davening is going to take during the week and on Shabbos is a factor in making it significant. Because how long do you think people will be into something? Even on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which sort of has like a, I like to say, it has its exit strategy of no one bothers with that, that's okay. But let's face it, if you're in shul for 10 hours, how much of that time are you really into davening? If you're in shul for 3 hours on Shabbos, how much time is spent? You think Kiddush clubs happen just because Jews needed a schnapps at the Haftorah? Kiddush clubs happen because davening took too long. The poor guy is hungry.
For some of us, the highlights of going to shul is the schmoozing part of,
yes,
you know, which is not necessarily davening or, you know, but you're all the gossip about what's going on and stuff.
Correct. Like that. But if davening on Shabbos morning is about an hour and 40 minutes, an hour and a half at least, right? An hour and 50 minutes, 2 hours max, versus 3 hours on a regular Shabbos morning, and then you go ahead and have a kiddush where you can schmooze, I believe you walk out of shul much on a higher feeling than if davening per se took 3 hours, because there was a yahrzeit and there was a bar mitzvah and the mishaberach we forgot and the this and the chazan used the slowest tune on earth. What are we gaining? What are you gaining? I know. You go to shul sometimes on the Shabbos, which is a Rosh Chodesh and Chanukah with the three Sifrei Torah. They put up the slowest guy in shul for Shabbos. A little brains wouldn't hurt sometimes. The slowest guy used the slowest tunes. Shacharis takes an hour and a half. You didn't even get to the three Sifrei Torah. An hour and a half shot. How much more time do you know? You look at your clock. You look at your watch. You think Kiddush clubs don't happen when this? Of course Kiddush clubs will happen. Kiddush clubs will stop if we invest time into the davening per se and the timing of davening. I'm not saying davening needs to be Speedy Gonzalez, but I also don't think davening has to be a turtle. Davening has to be at a pace where people will find it significant for them to come to shul, daven properly, and leave with that wow feeling that they can't get at home. Yes?
So one element to that is not just the melodies.
Correct.
You've got to pay attention to the words.
Absolutely.
And the basic Yisodos, Yisod Ein Torah. And that's lacking. I've been here in Seattle as a Ger V'Toshav now for about 3 years, and I've heard many, many, many rabbis from around the country applying to different congregations and so on. And one of the things that I have found consistently lacking is this idea that you're talking about of significance. People are talking about all kinds of issues that sometimes they're interesting, sometimes they're politically fascinating, but they miss the significance of the halachic structure, they miss the significance, as you put it, of the performance of the mitzvahs, they miss the content of what the mitzvahs are all about.
Yep.
And people are, they're thirsting for that information.
Mm-hmm.
They're thirsting for that knowledge.
I have to agree with you. I think people are thirsty today. Let's face it, we're in an information age. As I said earlier, what's happening out there comes into our shuls. We're in an information age, correct? People are on Google all the time, Googling this, Googling that. I mean, today, if you give a lecture to students in a classroom and they have laptops and you say a name, you don't need to prepare the biography. You ask a student, right, go on Wikipedia, find out when he lived. So I'm giving a class, Rambam. When is the Rambam? What's his real name? His mother, as I learned from Rabbi J.J. Schachter, I've repeated this all around, everyone loves it. I say, Rosh! His mother didn't say, Rosh Aleh! Come home for dinner! What was his real name? Where did he live? He was actually a person. I remember when I was in school, I never thought these people were people. I always thought they were names. Rashi is a name, he's not a person. What, he had a father? The first Rashi in Chumash, he quotes his father. You find out he had a father. I thought it was an immaculate conception until then. I didn't know he had a father. You know, well, all of a sudden today it's very simple. We're living in that information age. So if you're coming to shul and you don't get the basic structure of what davening is, what we're supposed to achieve, then you're right, something is lacking. Because all we're doing is saying the words. But I'll just give you a little secret. There is no, absolutely no, halacha that says that you have to say certain words of davening. There is a halacha you have to say Kriyat Shema. That's a halacha. Those are the words you say. There's a lip service obligation to say Kriyat Shema, thus it's called Kriyat Shema. We have an obligation to read the Torah, thus it's called Kriyat HaTorah. Is there an obligation to say certain words in the Siddur? The answer is no. There's an obligation of Avodah Shebalev, the work of the heart. The means to get there is the Siddur we use. So how can it be the work of the heart if we don't know what the sitter is about and what we're doing and where we're doing it? We know where to stand, we know where to sit, but we don't know why.
So the crisis is really more in Jewish education, not the synagogue.
Pardon?
If Jewish education is stronger, the synagogue would be stronger.
If Jewish education was stronger, the synagogue would be stronger. I agree. However, I don't like to always blame the schools for everything, even though, believe me, with the tuition prices that our people are paying in America, I can understand why you want to blame the schools. And it's a crisis, and I don't want to belittle it. It's a huge crisis, okay? It's very big. I think that education starts at home, and it starts home, for me, is also the synagogue. If in the synagogue we're talking about how this pasuk works out with that pasuk, because Rashi said so, but we're not talking about how come today when we opened the ark you stood up? Then what's happening? So you know why this pasuk connects to that pasuk. But the things you do all the time, the ark opening and whatnot, no one gets. No one understands. They do it, but they don't understand it. It becomes a very primitive religion. Because we open the ark, we close the ark, we say these words, we do it every week, and we don't know what we're doing. Imagine today trying to convince someone to enter that wonderful world where, come on in, it's a wonderful world. We open the ark, we close the ark, we take 3 steps back, 3 steps forward, and we don't know what we're doing. Come and join us. Who's going to join?
That's religion.
Yeah, but religion, in our religion...
That's not the Torah system.
The Torah system of religion was always a combined effort of doing mitzvot, of learning Torah and doing mitzvot. The Talmud, the Gemara has a big debate. What's greater, learning Torah or actually doing the mitzvot? And they have a big debate. It goes on and on, and finally they come to the conclusion that it's greater to learn Torah. Why? Ki haTalmud mivii liyedei ma'aseh. Learning will bring you to action. Let's just analyze those words. Learning will bring you to action. 6 words. What does that mean? Learning is going to bring you to action. It means that your learning will make your action significant. Now you'll know what you're doing and why you're doing it. You're not just going to do it. You're going to do it. And it's going to come from a point of view of knowledge. That's what I think the system was. Today, we do the opposite. We jump to the halacha. Let's give the class in halacha, and it's important. This is what we do. Well, if the Jewish home is a strong Jewish home, then I think they know how to keep Shabbos and Kashrus. They see it at home. So, let's learn why we do certain things. We're doing it. Why? What's the story? Sometimes we don't have an answer. I can promise you for many things, if not most of what we do, there are very good answers out there. You can ask the question, and now what? I did the mitzvah. Now what? What did it mean? What did it mean to you, mom, dad? What did it mean to you, rabbi? Oh, you know, I davened today. Yeah, but what did it mean to you? What? What did you daven for? We davened. You know, that's what Jews do. We davened. They go to shul, and they come out, and they say, we davened. Yeah, but what is it about? I think that's a question we can answer. And I think it's not just about davening, it's about the lighting of the candles every Friday night, and many other things we do all the time, which are beautiful and gorgeous, and God willing, we'll continue doing them. And we have to knock significance into them in our homes and in our synagogues. So I believe that if we combine both belonging and significance, we will be able to fill up more synagogues. If we totally continue the way we are, namely, we won't talk about belonging, we'll just say, Yeshar Koach, and we'll go ahead and just announce the anniversary and the death. I don't see the synagogues filling up. We have to give the people that sense of belonging. You're part of a group. And number two, significance. Yes?
So I tend to agree with you. I mean, what I have seen among particularly young people, I mean, I'm a professor at university, and University of Washington has a lot of Jews that don't want any relation with Judaism, is that it's not that the davening is long or the davening is large, is that they don't see that the Jewish practice will make you a better person in the world. That's the main problem. I mean, you get these people who, and we can talk about, you know, that go and shackle and daven and all that stuff, and then steal the rest of the week, you know. They daven on Shabbat and they steal the rest of the week. And it's not, for a young person, it's not clear that going to shul gives them anything that they need to put in their life.
which what they need to fulfill in their life is to give you a direction of what morality is and all the stuff that Judaism brings along.
Well, let's take that example of the university, because I think that's an excellent example. Your name again? I forgot.
My name is Wolf.
Wolf.
Zev.
Zev, Wolf. Okay, very nice. Zev? Wolf? In university, you come in, it's a very unfriendly place. A lot of students, no one really talks to you, everyone's on their cell phone and whatnot. Correct? Two, a lot of pressure to get on the dean's list. A lot of pressure to get high marks in order to get a good job afterwards. Okay? Where is the only place that you're going to feel a little whiff of home? It's going to be the JLIC rabbi or the Chabad rabbi or the Yesh rabbi who gives you that hot meal. But the hot meal is not good enough anymore. It's very nice to give him a hot free meal. Yes, I got a free meal and it was hot and it was even kosher. So here, he got all three. If you don't give him significance, you think they're going to come make your minion the next day?
That's precise.
My answer is absolutely not. Because if you cannot answer the question of, if I come to your minion, what do I get? Then you have a problem. Now in Europe, there are communities that answer that question. They said, let's make a minion. And the people asked, what do I get? You know what they got? Money. In many communities in Europe, they pay people to have a minion in the shul every day. And they come religiously for a few bucks and for breakfast. So that's what they get. Now, you want to build a Jewish community based on that? I don't. First of all, I'll go broke. Second of all, not only will I go broke, but quite frankly, once the money dries out, and it will, or once the breakfast is not delicious, and sometimes it does, it's not, they're not going to come. So we have to give them the answer to that question. If we can't answer it, we got a problem. You have to tell them, if you come, you will get something here that no one else can give you. I will be able to give it to you, or the synagogue rabbi will be able to give it to you, or my wife will be able to give you it, and that is significance to your life. And we're going to talk about not the Daf Yomi and not the Parsha. We're going to talk about what a student is dealing with when he's 19 or when she's 20. That's what we're talking about in this particular minyan we have. If you don't do that, then they don't have not the sense of belonging, and not maybe a little hot meal, but no sense of real belonging because they're just coming for the hot meal. No hot meal, they're not coming. And number two, they don't give them significance. And if we can't answer that question for that student, there's no way they're coming. And I'll tell you even worse, Mailer, 4 years in university, another 2 years graduate school. They're going to build Jewish homes, hopefully. We're going to lose them. Lose them to the Jewish people if in those initial years we don't give them significance and relevance. And most importantly, the sense of belonging to the Jewish community. If we cannot convey to them that, we have a big problem. If we cannot answer that student, if I come to your minyan, what do I get? We have a problem.
You know, you mentioned Rabbi Riskin. You know, when I was going to school in Boston, there was a general idea that you would do a pilgrimage to hear Rabbi Riskin drashes once
a month,
religiously. So there were so many students in Lincoln Square, in those years, my wife can tell you in her years about that. And that doesn't exist in most of the shuls I have belonged to. There is no relation. The University of Washington, 100,000 students, is very little relation between the shuls here and the university.
Just regarding lectures, I think you're right, that shuls have to look out for the local university. When I was a rabbi, even though it was not my job description and had nothing to do with me per se, it was five universities, one across the street. I felt I have an obligation, an achrayut, and a responsibility to be the rabbi of every Jew in the city, including the 500 Jewish students that came to my city not because they love Judaism. Trust me, they didn't leave Toronto and Montreal to come to Halifax because they love Judaism. Now, you didn't get to all of them, obviously. But we got to a select few, and Baruch Hashem, many of them have built wonderful Jewish families. They're not necessarily Shomer Shabbos, but they have a strong Jewish identity. They married a Jewish girl or boy, and they are building a Jewish future. And some of them are even getting to the age now where the big debate comes up. And I say, that's why I say the tuition crisis is the crisis, because these are people with strong identities, but $20,000 per kid with your strongest Jewish identity is hard. It's just physically hard on your bank account. Now, I believe that, yes, we have to take responsibility over Jewish students. But about lectures, I just want to say one thing. Once upon a time, there weren't so many TV channels. And if you wanted some recreation, you wanted some excitement at night, you either went to the movies, you went for a walk, or you went to a lecture. Yes, that was part of having fun. Today, you don't need to go to the movies because it's too expensive. You can download a movie onto your computer, watch it on your big screen in your room, connect your computer to it with a USB cable, or my favorite new one, the HDMI cable. Very useful, by the way, especially when kids are on vacation. They want to go to the movie. Hey, you want a movie? No problem. We download the movie all night. It's ready in the morning. Connect it up. Here's your movie. I'll pay for the popcorn. So lectures today, shiurim and all that, not too many will come. Because if they want Torah, they can get it on the net. And I think we have to be sensitive to that. So I personally don't measure success of a rabbi or success of a community by how many people come to the lectures of the rabbi during the week. I believe that every rabbi that gives shiurim can do it and should record it and put it on the net, on his website at the shul. And believe me, there are people in the shul that want to learn. If the lectures are good and significant, and they'll download the lecture afterwards and listen to it. So I give lectures in Efrat once a week to an English-speaking kollel. I have more listeners than people in front of me. How do I know this? Because very simple, you know how many people go onto the page once you put it up. And I'll tell you that if I'm not there like this week, probably, I usually give the lecture on Wednesday. I'm flying back to Israel, God willing, Wednesday night. Thursday, I am promise you when I get off the plane, I'll get two complaints from someone in the world that I don't even know. You didn't give a lecture this week? I was about to download it. What happened? They threw you out. So I think that today we have to be sensitive to the fact that people don't necessarily leave their homes at night for anything. Everything is on their computer. And therefore, we have to buy into it in a way by giving lectures and making sure they're on the net. And thank God the net is filled with endless lectures of endless rabbis. But they have to talk significant and relevant. They can't just talk about what bothers them. They have to talk about what bothers you. Shabbos is a good time to measure the success of the rabbi if this congregation is Shomer Shabbos and the rabbi gives a lecture on Shabbos and nobody comes to it, we got a problem. If it's the winter Shabboses and it's very short, I can also understand why no one comes. But if it's Shabbos that ends at 10 o'clock in the summer and he gives a lecture at 7 o'clock in the evening and it's Shabbos and it's a Shomer Shabbos crowd and nobody's coming, the rabbi better look at himself in the mirror very well. Yes?
So this may be not be the right forum for it, but you were talking about significance and relevance in like young people. So you go to young people, half of whom are women, and you say, hey, come to our shul and sit in this balcony, and all these guys are getting aliyot, yashikaya, so you sit up here, just, you know, sit there and maybe make some challah. So how do you build relevance and significance into women? And I ask because I know young women who are leaving because they feel that they are irrelevant to the religion and this is a man's religion.
Don't put them in the balcony.
That's true. Oh, don't put them in the balcony. That's one approach. But still, I mean...
You know.
It's a fact.
Look, I'm going to be very honest with you. Your name again?
Rivka.
Rivka. You know as well as I that women will not come to shul if that's what you're offering them. Young women will not be part of shuls if that's what you're offering them. Sit in the balcony, make the chillant, and we'll say, great, it was delicious. You know and I know, I won't get my daughter to go. Because there's nothing for her to go for if that's what you're offering her. So what are we offering her? So first and foremost, you all know that some of the answers to the dilemma we just heard was very simple. You make a shul like Shira Chadasha, where women do a lot, and ultimately they take the halacha and they expand it to the extent that they can. And ultimately, that's the shul that you have. You may be comfortable, uncomfortable with it on halachic grounds, on hashkafic grounds, on ideological and sociological grounds, but it's answering a need out there of women saying, we want to be part of the shul, but it's not significant to us if we sit in the balcony and do nothing. Just to paraphrase what I said, I remember the first time in Israel when I came back from my 4 years in Halifax, I was in shul, and there was a bat mitzvah. So I was interested, because I always struggled with a bat mitzvah. I'm about to tell you how. I always struggled with a bat mitzvah. Bar mitzvah, there's a protocol, right? You have to read the parsha, not the parsha, the haftorah. You throw candies. All of a sudden, all the kids in shul are dying of hunger. They grab those candies like they haven't seen candies in years. Never understood why. There's a protocol. What do you do with a bat mitzvah at an Orthodox shul? I struggled with it. So there's a bat mitzvah. So I was wondering, what's going to happen? This is what happened. The end of davening, the gabbai got up and said, we want to wish mazel tov to this girl for a bat mitzvah. And this is a gift for her, and we'll give it to you outside. And there was no kiddush. The second time it happened, there was a kiddush. So this time already, I said, okay. The first time there was no kiddush, she got nothing, so she gave nothing. Second time, she got the book, the same thing. The rabbi, not even a rabbi, says this, and there's a kiddush. So I went to the parents, and I said, may I ask you why you invited the entire shul to the kiddush of your bat mitzvah, of your daughter, when the shul did nothing for your daughter? I can understand if you have a private party, a bat mitzvah party for your friends, that I got. But you invited the whole shul. I was wondering why. They didn't know themselves. They basically said, I thought that's what you do.
Tradition.
Tradition, yeah. Fiddler on the Roof is a very important movie, on many accounts. Okay? Many accounts. Now, if we're offering what you just offered women, impossible. They're not coming. I don't see the future generation coming. You may go on the route of Shira Chadasha. If you like that route, if you feel that that's the way to go, if there's no choice, who knows? Who knows? I've seen that route. It doesn't necessarily talk to the women I come in contact with. It could talk to women, other women, and I understand them. Now, I also see halachic problems with the Shira Chadasha model, but they've solved it on their halachic grounds. In other words, they found solutions. I don't necessarily think they're good solutions, but okay. Now, if we're going to have our, what we call the normative Orthodox shul with the men doing everything, then the question is, how do we get women to come?
Feel significant.
First and foremost, there is absolutely no reason why in a shul that has separate seating with a mechitza or a balcony, their women are not acknowledged as much as men. So men get yesher koachs, and there's plenty of women that are active in shuls that should get the same recognition as men. First and foremost. Secondly, I say this personally, some shuls are very uncomfortable with what I'm about to say, but I personally see no reason why a rabbi needs to speak every single week. Eventually, he's going to repeat himself. So even if there's a shul with a rabbi that says in his contract he must give a sermon and he must give this, that, the other thing, a smart rabbi will go to his board and say, I want to involve women and men in Talmud Torah, because without it, it's not going to be significant. And therefore, I personally think that once a month, maybe once every 6 weeks, the rabbi won't give the sermon. Someone in the congregation will give the sermon. It doesn't have to necessarily be a man. It can also be a woman. She can either speak from the women's section, or if you want to go a step further, from the men's section. When? You'll break your heads when. Some people will say only at the end of Adon Olam and whatnot, fine. Some people will say, no, you can even do it in the middle of davening. And some people will say, it's absolutely immodest for a woman to open her mouth in front of men. She should absolutely always stop. Whatever it is. I personally see no problem that men and women today, just like we educate them pretty equally in our schools, in Torah education, men and women can give divrei Torah, and it could be done in a modest way, in a fine way. And what did you gain? You gain 2 more people, 4 more people, 6 more people, 10 people a year that are involved in Talmud Torah on a high level. They're about to give a sermon on Shabbos. Okay, 50 eyes are on them at least. So, they're going to prepare. Perhaps the rabbi will help them to prepare. They will deliver a sermon. I personally think that should not be limited to men. It should be men and women equally. On this issue, I personally do not have any problem with it. As to when they will give this sermon, will it be exactly where the rabbi usually speaks or at a different time? These are small semantic questions. Every shul will decide what their minhag on this issue will be. Number three. Not only do I think men and women can be recognized equally, giving them a sense of belonging. And secondly, significance. They'll both significantly be involved in Talmud Torah. I personally believe that when you talk about a shul, seating, and davening, everything we spoke about here, how come only the men are in the room? I'm not talking about davening. I'm talking about the chazanim we're going to pick for Rosh Hashanah this year. What, the women are not part of davening? They're there. So, for some reason that I never understood, when they decide that the chazan for Shachris, Musaf, Baal Tokeya, only men are in the room. Now, I'm not saying the women should be the Baal Tokeya. They're not chayev and shofar, so they can't fulfill the obligation for the men. I'm saying that the woman has a say in who should be the Baal Tokeya. Now let's face it, there's halachos in Shulchan Aruch about who can be a chazan. If a chazan, excuse me for saying so, has too many people that hate him, he shouldn't be the chazan. And we know many chazans like that. There's halachos in Shulchan Aruch. Now, if you only have men in the room, maybe he's buddy-buddy with the men, but he made disgusting comments to the women. So imagine how the woman feels where on the holiest days of the year, when she comes to shul and she's all ready to be spiritual, what's happening? When she's all ready to be spiritual, to be standing before God in judgment, and she's prepared. She looked at the machzor, she went to classes, she comes there, and who's leading the services? The man she can't stand. So therefore, on all those committees as to who can be chazanim, how long davening should be, everything we spoke about, men and women should be in the room, not just the men. Not just the gabbai and the rabbi. There should be women in there, and I can promise you, you'll hear different perspectives that you usually never hear when only the men are together. Number four. Not only do I think that women have to be recognized just like men in the announcements, and not only do I think that they can give Divrei Torah and it's fine. Where exactly and when, we can debate, but they can give Divrei Torah, in my humble opinion. And number three, they should be part of committees and shul just like men, because they either suffer or gain just like men. Number four, I personally believe that shuls today need women. Because women, in my opinion, are much more spiritual on certain issues than men. And if you want to give spirituality in shuls, the women need to be there to give that spirituality. And how do they give it? And how do we go ahead and plan a spiritual experience? We need women there for that. And finally, I don't think the women should be the only ones making the chulent.
In our shul, it isn't that case. We actually have a team making the chulent.
And you.
Yeah.
And you.
Yeah. Team.
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 I can tell you that I don't personally like the stigma of the women put out the kiddush and the men daven. I understand that men are chayev in davening in a minyan. Women are not chayevot in davening in a minyan. But when it comes to the kiddush, if it's important enough that you tell a woman, even though you're not chayevet and minyan, you can leave and go set up the kiddush, it's fine, then I think a man can also be told, you know, it's important enough, the kiddush is part and parcel of what we're trying to gain here, significance and relevance. After the kedusha of musaf, make your way down and set up the kiddush. Make your way down and make sure everything's ready. Friday afternoon, if you're important enough, you'll take your hour of lunch, and instead of going to somewhere and stuffing yourself just hours before you're going to stuff yourself on Shabbos, you can take your lunch break, go to shul, and put up the chulent. And I don't think that's like totally and utterly preposterous to do. So, you gave me the chulent model. I happen to think that the way you presented it, you're absolutely right, no women are coming to shul. But if we're able to successfully find ways to incorporate women and say women are part of the congregation just like men. There is a women's section and it's not by mistake, it's on purpose. We have to ensure the spirituality of women just like men. Now, if we cannot succeed in everything I just said, then perhaps we have to rethink the whole idea of a women's section. Maybe, I'm throwing this out, maybe it's a bad idea for men and women to daven in the same room, together, even with the mechitza. Perhaps, I'm throwing this out, there should be a men's prayer group and a woman's prayer group. Yes, a woman's prayer group is not a minyan, halachically. There's many things they will not be able to say, like Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, etc., all the things that necessitate a minyan. But I'm just throwing out that if women are not chayav in minyan, then maybe they don't have to daven in a minyan. And even though they're missing Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, and Kriyas HaTorah, perhaps women will get to higher spiritual levels if they daven in their room, and the men daven in their room, and then we come together for a Kiddush afterwards as one community. And both had a significant davening experience, and both came together afterwards as a community. I know it's a crazy idea, it's never been tried before, to my knowledge, properly. I know there's women's prayer groups, but many of them are like the Shirach HaDashah model I mentioned. I'm talking about a prayer group without all of that. Women davening together. No minyan, whatnot. Men davening together, because they do constitute a minyan with everything in a minyan. And then we come together for the Kiddush. Then you have a shul that's significant and relevant for men and women. So I think your question is very astute and very, very important. And we have to give a lot of thought. A lot of thought in the Orthodox world as to the place of women in Orthodox synagogues. We can't just say every form of new ideas that have to do with women is feminism. Feminism is terrible, and therefore it's wrong, and goodbye. Not every idea is terrible. There are ideas that I don't like, personally. There are ideas I can see the validity of and I'm not comfortable with. And there are ideas I'm 100% comfortable with. You can decide in your shul what it is. But the objective has to be the same, like I said an hour and a half ago. We have to create very steadfast, proud Jewish homes that are full of excitement for Judaism. And if we don't do that, because we're just running our shuls the way they always been run, then you're right. Why would women come to shul to set up the herring and the chulin for the kiddush? I don't know. I would not go to shul to set up herring. My hands would stink. And I don't know. Why would I do that? Baruch Hashem. Even though it's against the Jewish custom. But okay, you use gloves. Thank God. To make a long story short, I think that the biggest challenge will start when a girl becomes bat mitzvah. Because that's the time where the boy has this big event. And what is the girl going to have? So what I described to you before about the present at the end of davening with the mazel tov, I don't know if that's going to do it. Is she going to come back next week? I'm not so sure. We have to give a lot of creative thought as to how to do a bat mitzvah in a shul. And I have ideas on this, because every bat mitzvah I did during my years in the rabbinate was different from the other bat mitzvah, because each bat mitzvah girl was different. And each one had something different that they did. Some did not want to give a sermon in the shul in front of everyone. Some did. Some did a presentation of artwork and whatnot that talked about her Judaism after davening in a separate room. And that made it for her. And all her friends came and whatnot. So to say that a bat mitzvah is a bat mitzvah, you just have a party. I personally think a bat mitzvah should be celebrated in the shul just like a bar mitzvah. The difference is, we can't do it in the same way necessarily. So we have to put on our thinking caps, as our mothers told us. And we have to be creative and find ways to incorporate it into the shul environment. If not, the shul again will not be relevant, will not give any significance to these women. Any other questions? That I really don't think we solved the world's problems tonight.
No, but you weren't just your shikayach.
Thank you. So I want to thank you for listening. I've let off a lot of steam tonight, and I'm glad you were here to hear it. I can go to sleep like a baby now. I really wish you a lot of success in all the endeavors you're doing in order to create synagogues that are relevant, that have significance, and that make that sense of belonging. I believe that is the wave, and that is the calling of our generation. And to take the words of the Chidushei Harim, I quote it to heart, Binu Shnot Dor Vador, if we learn the generation, we understand that we're living in a generation of cell phones and institutions are out. We have to create an institution that people would like to come to. And in my opinion, if we can take these two elements, belonging on the one hand and significance on the other, and incorporate it into our shuls, then men and women, in my opinion, will want to come to shul, will want to be part of the shul, and I'll even add, will even pay for it. People pay for good things. They pay for a nice hotel. They pay for a nice vacation. They pay for things that are good for them. And if the shuls are good for them, they will pay membership dues to shuls as well. They will pay for a rabbi's salary, full-time salary, none of this part-time. I have always, when I get the part-time positions, first of all, I can't send rabbis from Israel part-time. What are they going to do for the rest of the time? They don't live here. And number two, I think there's something fishy. What do you mean part-time rabbi? What do you mean part-time? There's no such thing.
Part-time salary, full-time work.
You got it. There's no such thing. They will even pay for full-time rabbis because they're getting money back for their dollar. They're getting significance and they're getting belonging that they can't get without it. I wish you a lot of luck and I wish us all a lot of luck to, God willing, create more and more synagogues like this. We have a wonderful, wonderful Jewish community and we just need to find a way to get them in the door. And in my humble opinion, if they get into the door and they get significance and relevance and belonging, Be'ezrat Hashem, with God's help, we'll have a future that we can be proud of. Thank you all very much.